The next case this morning is Skinner versus Barnhart. Ms. Coleman.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Marcy Goldblum, representing plaintiff appellant in this case. Social Security ruling 96-3P sets forth exactly what the administrative law judge has to consider when deciding if there's a severe impairment. And the Social Security ruling makes very clear that it's not just the objective medical evidence that the judge has to consider, but the judge also has to consider the subjective complaints as well as the medical that's underlying it. And that Social Security ruling teaches that if there is a medically determinable underlying impairment that could reasonably cause the complaints of the individual, then the administrative law judge can't dismiss it at that point, but has to go on. And what the ruling specifically says is, even if the objective medical evidence would not in itself establish that the impairment is severe, the judge can't dismiss it as non-severe at that point if those complaints, if those symptoms are reasonably related to the underlying medical condition. In this case, the judge didn't follow that ruling. This claimant, had objective evidence of underlying medical impairments. She had diabetes. She had hypertension. The record also showed EKG evidence of voltage criteria for left ventricular hypertrophy and considerations of inferior and anterior lateral ischemia. She complained throughout the record of dizziness, of headaches, of fatigue, some difficulty standing, some intermittent chest pains, for which she was actually prescribed NitroQuick. But in addition to not just following Social Security ruling 96-3P, there were further errors in this case. To begin with, as the district court recognized, there was not a valid waiver of the right to counsel. That's not in dispute. But where the district court erred was finding that the plaintiff wasn't prejudiced as a result of that, because she was. Let's take a look and see, what would an attorney have done in this case? Well, the first thing an attorney would have done in this case is remind the administrative law judge of Social Security ruling 96-3P that teaches exactly what the judge has to consider in looking at what is a severe impairment. An attorney would have also actually made sure that his client was at the hearing. And that was real crucial in this case, because once you accept the fact that there were underlying impairments that could have reasonably caused the complaints that this woman had, then the administrative law judge really needed to make a credibility finding, which he never does. He needed to make this credibility determination, and so it was incumbent upon him to make it clear to this unrepresented claimant with an 11th grade education that her testimony was important, was crucial. Now, defendants provided to our attention the Sixth Circuit's case of Holland versus the Commissioner. Now, in that case, the Sixth Circuit found that there had been a valid waiver of the right to appear, but let's look at what happened there. In that case, the administrative law judge who's reviewing the case takes a look at everything, realizes that this is a close case. He specifically sends a letter to the individual and says, Ms. Howland, your testimony is crucial here. It's in your best interest to come and testify, and nevertheless, that claimant chose not to. There's no evidence in this case that the administrative law judge reviewing Skinner's case ever contacted her. He should have. Under Social Security ruling 7919, in order for there to be a valid waiver of the right to appear at the hearing, the claimant has to actually be aware of how crucial their testimony could be. Well, in this case, where it really comes down to her credibility, her testimony was essential, and that was not made clear to her. Now, defendant may argue that, well, there wasn't clear evidence that her complaints were really reasonably related to her underlying impairments. But that doesn't pass muster for a couple of reasons. Number one, she was complaining of things that are reasonably related to diabetes, to hypertension, but also she related that she was having side effects to her medication. Her medication was enalapril, glipizide, and Lipitor. All of those medications have side effects that are very consistent with everything she's been reporting. The judge never talks about that. What the judge basically does is he confines himself to what does the objective medical evidence show us here, and that is a violation of Social Security Ruling 96-3P. The judge also says, hey, well, you know what? There was a report from one of her treating doctors that says, hey, she's feeling better, she could work. But that doesn't do it either, because let's take a look at what really happened there. All along, this woman, and again, this is a woman with an 11th grade education who's Medicaid dependent. She's having all these symptoms. She thinks they're all related to medication that she's on for her hypertension. She's on Procardia. She thinks that all of these symptoms are related to it. And she comes in November 14th, and she says to the treating physician, because they're going to take her off of the Procardia that she thinks is causing all of her symptoms, and she says, you know, I'm feeling better. I think I could work. And the doctor agrees with her. However, let's look at what happens after that when she's no longer taking the Procardia. She's taking different medication. December 17th, 2002, the reports say she's having bad days. She feels weak and unable to do normal activities. March of 2003, she's complaining of dizziness. June 4th of 2003, she's complaining of fatigue, headaches, having good and bad days, and orthostatic symptoms of dizziness and lightheadedness when standing up. Now, the judge recognizes the idea of good days and bad days, but he concludes that she's having more good days than bad days. Now, I don't know where he's coming up with that. It could be the amount of time she's at the doctor, but again, this is a Medicaid-dependent individual. We don't know how often she's able to get to the doctor. But another thing is that when he's deciding if she has a severe impairment, he has to look at whether there's more than a minimal impact on her ability to do basic work activities. Well, if she's having bad days a couple times a month, that's going to have an impact on her ability to do basic work activities. If she can't be there, she's not doing the job. The judge didn't consider any of these things. So all of these errors are compounded. He didn't follow the requirements of Social Security Ruling 96-3P. There was no valid waiver of her right to an attorney to represent her. There really was no valid waiver of her right to appear at the hearing because she did not have any clue of just how essential her testimony was in this case. She signed a form that said, I recognize my testimony could be useful, could be helpful. But useful and helpful, that's not the same thing as essential. It's a huge distinction in this case. The ALJ, when there's an unrepresented claimant, as the Thomas case teaches us, says that there's a special duty assigned to the administrative law judge which requires essentially a record which shows that the claimant was not prejudiced by lack of counsel. I don't think there's any way we can look at this case and see that this unsophisticated individual, 11th grade education, dependent on Medicaid, was not prejudiced by her lack of counsel here. I mean, at the very least, as I said, the attorney is going to make it clear to the administrative law judge that he has to follow his agency's ruling in determining whether there was a severe impairment. And lest the government argue that, well, you know what, it's all harmless error because, you know, even if there was a severe impairment, so what, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of evidence of a disabling impairment. But that's not a proper view of the case. But moreover, some of the things that this woman has been complaining of, she says that she's dizzy. She said that she has problems doing her household chores because she can't stand very long. Well, if the administrative law judge were to make a credibility finding, had he credited that information, then there's a good likelihood that he would have found, you know what, this 51-year-old woman, maybe she's limited to sedentary work. Well, it's sedentary work. The Social Security administration's medical vocational guidelines, known as the GRID, direct at 20109 that she's disabled, and which is very similar to when her doctor says in November of 2002 she could do some work. We have no idea what she meant by she could do some work. Did the doctor mean she could do some sedentary work? Because again, under Social Security guidelines, that's consistent with a finding of disability. Did she mean that this individual could do part-time work? We don't know. And we don't know because the administrative law judge did not fully and fairly develop the record. I see my time is done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Ahmed?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Mona Ahmed. I represent the Commissioner of Social Security. The argument that was just presented by counsel and the arguments that were made in the appellant's reply brief bear very little resemblance to the arguments that were made initially in the main brief, and most of those arguments are waived because they weren't presented in the main brief. In Ms. Skinner's main brief, she argued that she had listing-level diabetes because there was evidence of diabetic acidosis based on blood tests. In fact, what the medical evidence showed, that was not a blood test that she was citing. It was a urine test, and it was normal. In her main brief, Ms. Skinner also argued that there were blood tests showing acute cardiac damage. In fact, that test was also normal. Those erroneous statements of the evidence were pointed out in the commissioner's brief, and given the fact that the entire premise of Ms. Skinner's arguments collapsed in light of those misstatements of evidence, I think the arguments have now changed into something different. The arguments that are made overlook a number of key pieces of evidence, and also there are a number of misstatements in the reply brief that I think warrant this court's attention. First of all, Ms. Skinner overlooks the very important fact that there are two state agency medical consultants who reviewed the medical evidence in this case. The first review was conducted in August of 2002, the second in November of 2002. Those reviews done by the state agency medical consultants, both expert physicians indicated that Ms. Skinner did not have a severe impairment as that is defined in the commissioner's regulations. Ms. Skinner has never once recognized that those medical opinions exist and absolutely support the ALJ's finding that Ms. Skinner's diabetes and her hypertension were not severe impairments.
Could I ask you a question about the waiver of counsel form or the explanatory forms that were provided to Ms. Skinner? And apparently they're form documents of the Social Security Administration, but they haven't been updated to reflect the requirements of case law in terms of what warnings are supposed to be given to effectuate a valid waiver of counsel. It's my understanding that you've conceded that those forms were inadequate. Why haven't they been updated?
In terms of complying with what this court said in Thomas and Binion, is that what you're
right.
asking? Because there are two issues. There's an issue as to Ms. Skinner waiving her appearance.
Right,
her personal appearance.
That's separate. But my understanding is that warning was adequate, and she received it and signed it. But you've conceded right. that the warnings about her right to have an attorney was inadequate under
right.
case law.
I mean, the notices that that are provided at the initial level, after an initial denial and after a reconsideration denial, those notices provide the information about counsel that is that is required by the Social Security Act and by the Social Security regulations. Those notices are consistent with what the agency requires and what Congress has required the agency, the information that the Congress has required the agency to provide to claimants. In terms of this court's rulings in Thompson and Binion, which go beyond what Congress told us we had to do, I think, there's a little bit of tension between what this court instructs the agency to advise claimants about and what the Social Security Act advises about how attorney fees are calculated and approved. And because of that tension, I think that the additional waivers required by this court or the additional information required for valid waiver by this court are typically given by the ALJ at the hearing. And in fact, in Thompson, this court seemed to suggest that even if the written notices were sufficient, that the ALJ is still required to go beyond that and give the additional information at the hearing. And because there was no hearing in this case, I think that's where it fell through the cracks in this case. I think, going back to the arguments that were made in the main brief and how they have morphed over time, in the main brief, Ms. Skinner cited a medical text, the Merck manual, which she claimed that according to this text, hypertension causes this whole host of symptoms, which include dizziness, headaches, fatigue, nosebleeds. Nosebleeds, something Ms. Skinner never complained of. But in any event, that medical text actually says that dizziness, headaches, fatigue, and epistaxis, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's nosebleeding, that those symptoms are not caused by hypertension if the hypertension is uncomplicated. What this record shows is that Ms. Skinner had hypertension that was clearly uncomplicated. The blood pressure readings that are consistently documented through the record indicate, mild, on a few occasions, moderate hypertension, but overwhelmingly those readings indicated mild hypertension. The diabetes that Ms. Skinner had was again, controlled by medication after it was initially diagnosed, took some time to get it under control, but well within 12 months after the initial diagnosis, her blood sugar readings were well within the normal range. And all of that goes to support the ALJ's finding that these were not impairments that significantly affected her ability to do work activities. I want to draw your attention to a statement that's made in the reply brief. In her main brief, Ms. Skinner calls step two a de minimis test, which she says was upheld by the Supreme Court in the Yuckert case. Now, we made the point in the commissioner's brief that, in fact, the Supreme Court in Yuckert did not endorse step two as being a de minimis test. In the reply brief, Ms. Skinner persists in this argument, going so far as to directly quote the Supreme Court. On page 6 of the reply brief, there's a direct quote from the Yuckert case saying that the test for proving a severe impairment is a de minimis one, and claimants need only prove that their impairments cause them more than a slight abnormality with minimal effect on their ability to work. Now, that quoted language appears nowhere in the Yuckert opinion that I could find. And in fact, I don't see anything even remotely resembling that language in the Yuckert opinion. There's another misquote on page 18 of the reply brief, quoting another Supreme Court case, Goss versus Lopez. A quote about the ALJ's obligation to inform himself about facts relevant to the decision. Again, a quote that doesn't appear in the Goss decision. Really, what Ms. Skinner is asking this court to do is overturn a well-supported opinion based on sort of nitpicking at the evidence. And this court has indicated in the Johnson versus Apfel case, 1999 case, that, you know, we're going to look at the ALJ's decision and give it a common sense reading, and we're not going to nitpick at it. And if you give this decision a common sense reading, looking at the evidence, it has to be affirmed. We have two expert state agency medical consultants who looked at the medical evidence, said these are not severe impairments. We have Ms. Skinner's own doctor looking at her treatment over, and the status of her medical condition, and saying that she's capable of working given her chronic medical conditions. Those medical opinions are uncontradicted. There is no doctor who said anything different, who remotely suggests that her impairments are limiting her in any way. And Ms. Skinner herself agreed that she was capable of working. The evidence overwhelmingly shows that her conditions are controlled by medication. She experienced no complications from her hypertension or from diabetes. When she went to the doctor for her periodic checkups, every two, three, 4 months, she said, you know, the way she described her symptoms was intermittent. She described them as mild. She described them as even fleeting. She said, I have these, you know, pains at the top of my head, and I get dizzy when I stand up, and those symptoms are fleeting. I see I'm out of time, but I had a lot more to say.
Thank you, counsel. But
thank you very much.
The case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the last case this